And next item is 1100.
Enhance community service opportunities and strengthen the transparency and accountability of city advisory bodies.
And I'm sorry, I'm not sure who opens with this.
I'll open.
Commissioner Fish, thank you.
Thank you, Mayor and colleagues. Welcome, people who are still here after a long day. I am very pleased to co-sponsor this resolution with my colleagues, Chloe Udaly and Amanda Fritz. Here's the run of show. I'll provide a few opening comments, and then other members of the council will make opening comments. We will then place proposed amendments on the table for your consideration. We have an invited panel, and then we'll take testimony. We'll break for dinner. We'll come back and have a further discussion. We'll break and then pick it up at breakfast. That's the run of show, and we're losing the mayor at 3:45. So I will curb the humor and try to get to the meat of this. The premise of today's proposed action is that we make better decisions when we partner with the community, and that the city needs to do a better job of providing volunteers who serve on advisory boards and commissions with the tools they need to be successful. In May, Council directed the City Attorney's Office to develop a package of updates to standardize our policies and procedures and to clarify the expectations of all involved, city staff, community members, and decision makers. Today, we are forwarding that package of reforms and updates to the Council for consideration. Like many others, I became interested in this issue after learning that we did not have clear standards governing public service on advisory bodies, nor did we consistently require disclosures of conflicts of interest as a condition of service. The package of proposed reforms and updates before you today was developed by the City Attorney's Office in consultation with the Office of Neighborhood Involvement, the Office of Equity and Human Rights, individual council officers and commissioners, city staff, and, of course, members of the public. The goal in establishing citywide standards is fourfold. First, to advance meaningful public involvement. Second, to provide consistency and clarity on the role of advisory bodies. Third, to daylight conflicts of interest. And four, to give community members greater confidence in the value of their service. We have before us for your consideration today the following: a uniform application, which includes a conflict of interest disclosure form, training materials for both advisory board members and staff, options to track the delivery of that training, a template for standard bylaws, an exit survey to be completed by members at the end of their service, and values to guide our selection process. Colleagues, I want to preview for you one of my amendments we will be considering today. The original draft of the bylaws, as filed, contained a restriction on members' abilities to speak freely with the media. This language was not something that any of the sponsors discussed, much less agreed to. So my First Amendment, emphasis on the pun, will remove the restrictive language while highlighting the need for transparency in the deliberation of the various advisory bodies. With that, I'd like to invite my co-sponsors and other members of the council to make opening comments, after which, Mayor, I will try to organize an orderly process for putting amendments on the table, and then we'll invite our first panel to come forward. So, colleagues?
Commissioner.
Yes, thank you, Commissioner Fish. So shortly after taking office, my staff was approached by a number of constituents about ideas they felt could help the city be more effective. One of those ideas was asking if the Office of Neighborhood Involvement could somehow provide more direction and guidance to all of the bureaus in how they engage, recruit, and manage advisory bodies. The concerns ranged from the fact that, at least the perception that the same few people were being tapped over and over again to serve on multiple bodies, to what happens to the work product volunteers put so much time, energy, and expertise into creating. I'm pleased to say that this ordinance today is part one of addressing those issues. Today, we are setting the stage for a more cohesive, collaborative vision of how public engagement with the city via boards and commissions will work moving forward. By standardizing our systems across all bureaus, we're making sure that every volunteer who chooses to spend their time and expertise with the city will know what to expect, understand their responsibilities, and ensure that we are all following the law. But we still have more work to do. After the stage is set today, my staff, in partnership with staff from Commissioner Fritz's office, as well as ONI, will begin the important work of creating best practices guidelines for recruitment and retention. I'm looking forward to seeing those proposals come before council sometime in the spring. I also look forward to hearing from our staff, as well as public testimony, about the work done so far. And now Commissioner Fritz would like to say a few words.
Thank you, colleagues. I'm really excited about this. I was, as many people know, on the Planning Commission back when it was called the Planning Commission, and I was on it for 7 years. So I've had many, lots of thinking about this over the past, however many years it is, a lot. I was also engaged in the 2011 Charter Review Commission, and I'd asked Brian Hoop, who's formerly with the Office of Neighbourhood Associations. It does not surprise me at all that you are here today to follow this through now that we're at the Office of Neighbourhood Involvement. Brian Hoop put together a kind of a survey to find out who was serving on our boards and commissions so that we could appoint a charter commission from these members. And it turned out that there were significant disparities in who was serving on the commissions and committees and the general demographics of the population. So that was really... when I started looking at not only that, but with the Office of Equity and Human Rights being formed, how can we invite more people to be engaged in this? Because I found it a wonderful experience being on the Planning Commission. Totally overwhelmed to start off with. Would have loved some of these trainings and onboarding and all those the things that we're now putting into place. And I learned a lot, and I felt I had a voice. I knew I wasn't making the decisions, but I was having a voice in recommending to the Commission, to the Council. So I'm very, very excited about this process. It does many things. One of it provides clarity. It also provides training. As Commissioner Udaly said, it specifies very clearly what the legal requirements are and what the aspirational values are as well. Commissioner Fish provided the amendment taking out the language on talking to the media. I support taking that language out, and I learned to my detriment that talking to the media before I talked to any of my colleagues on the Planning Commission was probably not a good thing to do because it didn't help us really discuss things in an open and transparent way. I'm very concerned that some boards and commissions currently don't have any term limits. And over the time that I've been on the council the last 9 years, I've had many opportunities to appoint or reappoint. I also had the duty, which was not quite so pleasant, of informing people who had been on a committee within Parks for the past 20 years that I thought it would be good to have some new people around the table. And so we need to make more room for people at the table because there are lots of people who want to step up and help our communities, and that's what we're aiming to do, one of the things we're aiming to do right now.
Commissioner Fish.
So thank you very much, and I want to second what Commissioner Fritz just said. We're not going to prescribe what people can do in terms of talking to the media, but we hope in the selection process and in the training and in the spirit of what we're trying to achieve here that people understand that having discussions at the table with colleagues is usually more fruitful than going around that process prematurely. Doesn't restrict anyone's right to talk to the media at any time on any subject, but it's certainly not our intent to regulate that. But our goal is to create a set of protocols that actually enhance the value of people's public service. And that's what this first step attempts to do. I believe there are a total of 5 amendments which will be offered. Mayor, my suggestion is each one be placed on the table and seconded so that we can get public testimony. And I'd like to begin with Commissioner Udaly.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner Fish. So I have slightly updated language to this amendment.
Okay.
It is add to Exhibit D, Bylaws Template, Section V, General Operating Procedures, a bullet after the first bullet. that states, when the conflict of interest could result in a direct financial benefit to themselves or relatives as defined in state law, a public official shall refrain from voting on the issue, although discussion and participation is still allowed.
So that is Udaley 1, Mayor, and I think the shorthand way of looking at that is a proposal for recusal. So thank you very much, colleague.
Yes. And I second for the purpose of discussion.
Okay, so Commissioner Udaley moves. Commissioner Fritz seconds.
Commissioner Fritz.
I just handed away all my copies of what I was talking about.
Oh, sure.
Thank you. Earlier we're talking about minority reports, and I think it's very important. I know it's very important to the council that we do hear minority opinions. We don't expect our boards and commissions to come to complete consensus, and it's very helpful to us to hear what the discussion was and what the different sides or many sides might agree. So I'm moving to add the following language to the resolution. Whereas the City Council seeks to understand not only the conclusions of the body, but also the substance of its deliberations, and for that reason encourages the submission of minority reports along with the majority recommendation. And then there'll be a training slide that we'll see that the City Council is interested not only what I just said, we're putting that into a training session, and members are encouraged to develop and submit minority reports if the advisory body does not reach a consensus recommendation.
So, Mayor, I will second that amendment. That's Fritz number 1, and it addresses minority reports. Commissioner Fritz.
I don't think I have another one, do I?
Okay, so that brings it back to me. And I should note, before I offer my amendments, that we have received a letter for the League of Women Voters of Portland, which I've circulated to my colleagues. And in the letter, they address, among other things, term limits and the recusal proposal. So that will be made part of the record. I have 3 amendments. The first is Fish 1, which deletes the following language from Exhibit D, Bylaws Template, Section X, Communications, and it is the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th bullet points which impose restrictions on the right of members to talk to the media. And Dan seconds that. Thank you. And so that is Fish 1.
No, I'm sorry. I apologize. Did we get one of these?
We've got that already.
That we'll call Fish 1, and perhaps as a tip of the hat to Jim, Redden,
okay.
We'll call that the reversal of the so-called gag order in the bylaws. Fish 2, so I have 2 other amendments which I'm going to offer, and offer a tip of the hat to Tracy Prince, who, in fairness, while there's a lot of people in this room who care passionately about these issues, Tracy's passion has been boundless. And we got an email from her outlining concerns she had with the legislation. So I have prepared 2 amendments for the council's consideration, which are designed to address concerns that she's raised. I am not offering them as Tracy's amendments because she is free to tell me that I got it wrong or to seek to enhance them, but I want to have them on the table for consideration. So Fish Amendment 2, add to Exhibit D, Bylaws Template, Section 5, Roman numeral 5, General Operating Procedures, comma. This is the bullet after the last bullet that states, quote, staff are obligated to keep a record of all conflicts of interest that are announced during each meeting. So I offer that as Fish Amendment 2.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Fish and Fritz.
Okay.
That's Fish number 2.
And Fish 2, we'll just call a conflict record keeping. I have 1 additional amendment, which we'll call Fish 3. Add to Exhibit D, Bylaws Template, Section 5, General Operating Procedures, bullet after the last bullet states as follows, quote, if it is found that a member did not disclose a conflict of interest, staff must alert the Bureau Director of that instance. I offer that as Fish Amendment 3.
Second.
Commissioner Fish moves. Commissioner Fritz seconds. Fish number 3.
Colleagues, are there any other amendments that you wish to offer at this time? So, Mayor, may I continue?
I'm going to be later offering an amendment on Commissioner Udaly's amendment.
Okay. So, at this point, it's my great honor to invite our first panel. If you would please come forward. Judy Prosper from the Office of the City Attorney, Ashley Horn from the Office of Neighborhood Involvement, and Kofi Desu from the Office of Equity and Human Rights. And I would like to take a moment as the three of you get settled to especially thank Judy Prosper for her work on this project over the past year. She is quite literally the driving force behind this proposal at the staff level, and we would not be here today without her outstanding work. So, Judy, thank you for your service. And with that, I will recognize Judy Prosper.
My apologies, first and foremost. I think I'm far enough away from all of you that no one will get sick. And I'm sorry to my colleagues here. I just came down with something awful. Thank you for that introduction, and good afternoon to you, Mayor Wheeler and commissioners. As you stated, I'm Judy Prosper, one of the deputy city attorneys here. A little bit of background, how I became involved in this project. Early in my tenure with the city, I was working with a newly formed board, and various issues arose. We started trying to tackle each issue as it came up, and that seemed like an impossible task. So two things jumped out at me. One was that members of the advisory boards did not know of their status as public officials, nor the obligations and responsibilities that flowed from that. And the second was that no one told them. So, needing to resolve some of the issues that came up, I culled the existing work of colleagues, looked through relevant law, and put together a 50-slide training that was delivered via PowerPoint. It is in your packets. I have it loaded. In case there are questions later, I can pull a slide here and there to respond to those. The training is offered as on an as-needed basis, as folks request it. Myself or one of my colleagues will deliver it to new boards, existing boards, or whatever's requested. The crux of it was to introduce the pillars of being a public official and, again, the obligations. I have a slide, and how do I get this, a slideshow? Just kind of click this here. You don't have to see me. Sorry, this is really hot. Change your perfect. Yeah, and then it'll just like, it'll pop up. Thank you. I just want to make a quick note because when we had some focus groups of staff members and some issues came up that we want to just put forth. And that is to distinguish appeals boards, boards that make final decisions, and any board created by charter from advisory boards, which we're here to discuss today, advisory boards that are created by council, by code, or by a bureau. Appeals boards do make final decisions, even if their decision can be appealed to a higher authority. Boards like FPDR, who make final decisions, and any board created by charter, including FPDR, is not the subject of our work here today. They're not advisory in the sense that I describe.
And Judy, can I just jump in?
Please.
It's very important you make that distinction because we have heard from some interest groups that were concerned about the impact of what we're doing on, say, confidentiality agreements that they enter into as a part of being a deliberative body and receiving information. Maybe it's police accountability work or other kinds of things. And so there are a different body of laws and rules that apply to bodies that make final decisions or have a higher level of decision making. We are talking purely about advisory boards that serve at the discretion of the council, and therefore it's a different standard.
Exactly so. Okay, so the three basic pillars of being a public official, there they are. The three basic pillars of membership in a body, and they are being a public official, whether you're sitting in a public or private meeting, and whether you're to keep public records. I'll go. So my recommendation, of course, and this is part of the plan, is that all staff, all members of advisory boards should receive this training in one form or another. There'll be additions based on what is decided here today. And then an additional training for bureau liaisons in addition to what the volunteers receive with information on how to help them effectively staff those boards. So this next slide, through our work, we've decided, or it sort of shook out when we did an inventory of all the advisory bodies that came back from the May inventory. There are really three types of advisory bodies. The bona fide governing body of a public body that's a collective cull of ideas to advise this body, a public body council, by a designated group of individuals and is ongoing. The second type is a little bit of a deviation from that, and that are those limited boards that are pop-ups for a specific reason. They're still advising council, but they have a limited duration and they're issue-specific. The third type of board is a little bit different. It's before bringing an idea to council or implementing it at the bureau level, city staff, are to gather input from a variety of stakeholders or designated constituencies, and then the staff members incorporate those ideas into a final product or proposal. City staff members are the ones doing the work. What distinguishes 1 and 2 from 3 is that 1 and 2 bodies come directly to council. And as an example, if staff disagree with what the body has come up with, the body can come straight to council and give their input and conclusions and such based on their votes at their meetings. A type 3 board is a board that is advising a person who works for the city. That is one of you, a bureau director, anyone inside a bureau who's managing a project. And the person responsible for the work product is the staff member. So that's sort of a distinction, and maybe we'll get to that later if you have questions. And just to point out here, there are also alternate means, rather than putting together a type 1, 2, or 3 board, to gather community input. You can have a town hall, or you can simply have a meeting in your office of various folks who you want to give input on a topic. One other key distinction between ones and twos together and threes is that quorums and votes are not required in the third, in type threes. And you can use other means. I've heard of taking the temperature of the room by using red, yellow, and green flags, by having a show of hands, or how many people kind of feel this way. When you're in a one or two, a board that advises council, you have to use the quorum rules per state law, and your votes are going to need to be tallied. Okay, disclosure. Oregon state law considers appointees to city advisory bodies public officials and requires disclosures of conflicts of interest. Members of all three categories of advisory bodies are public officials. Under Oregon Revised Statute 244.020.3, a person has a conflict of interest when participating in an official action, a vote, which is potentially or would actually result in a financial benefit or avoidance of detriment to the public official, a relative of the public official, or a business with which that person is associated. Additionally, Portland City Code Chapter 1.03, our code of ethics here, requires advisory members to uphold a specific standard of behavior. The language is included as part of the application form, which someone will speak to later, advising volunteers from the beginning when they're coming in to volunteer and sign up to get on a board or ask to be selected for a board, they have that information. So some definitions from this slide. So Oregon state ethics law defines business with which a person is associated as when during a preceding calendar year the person is a director, officer, owner, employee of a private or closely held corporation and has $1,000 worth of stock. Or when during the preceding calendar year a person owns $100,000 worth of stock in a publicly held corporation. And it not only the person, but an appointee or relative is a director of a publicly held corporation. And then again, when an appointee is required to file an annual verified statement. The definition of relative is very vast. Your spouse, your children, the children of your spouse, that is your steps, your siblings, or in-laws, spouses of sibling, that's in-laws, parents, parents of your spouse, your in-laws the other way, and anyone basically who provides financial support to a member of your household. These are the state, this is the state law definition of who a relative is. Again, these last two bullets are for, I know it's, the text is going over it, but the last two bullets are basically for households of unmarried people, but who provide support to each other. State law counts those, the monies and the interests as relatives. Excuse me.
Could I ask you a question on that? No, hopefully it'll give your poor voice an opportunity to recover a bit. Thank you for being here. Uh-huh. I have often wondered, is the standard here a conflict of interest would be if a sibling had a direct interest in a company and you were making a decision about it? That is technically a conflict of interest, correct?
Yes. Yes.
So here's where it gets weird. Mm-hmm. So bear with me.
Yeah.
Is it the obligation of the person on the body to disclose known conflicts of interest, or is it to disclose those conflicts of interest? And the reason I ask, and I'm not personalizing this to anybody anywhere near this room, but what if you are estranged from your sibling and you have no idea what their financial interests are? How does that work?
That's a very interesting question. The way I read the statute, it is meant, you know, sort of those folks that you can reach out and touch that are in your realm. I actually don't have an answer to an estranged relative on the list, how that would count. I don't want to guess what the OGC would do, but I think logic would have to sort of prevail in that situation if someone were to bring a claim against someone before the OGC. I think I would hope that the OGC would use logic in that case. When they were thinking of a penalty.
Okay. But you can't disclose what you don't know.
Correct.
So at that point, I suppose if a strange person comes and says, by the way, I own that property, at that point you would have to say, I just found out my estranged sister owns this.
I don't want to sound like the lawyer here, but I'm guessing the Ethics Commission would say something like, what reasonable steps did you take to learn? So there's no ostrich defense. And I'm guessing that there's a lot of estranged sibling who served on closely held boards of closely held companies. So you know about that. But the other things, I think, is probably a subject of a reasonable inquiry standard, my guess. Again, I'm not a practicing lawyer anymore, but I'm just guessing.
Okay. I mean, it's an interesting question because, you know, I'm not estranged from my siblings. We're close. I have no idea what their business dealings are. I'm not sure they'd tell me if I asked. Thank you.
You're welcome. So a public official is required, this is again all under Oregon law, to make an announcement of the nature of a conflict of interest each time the issue gives rise. And it needs to be made on each occasion, and each occasion has been determined to mean one time per meeting, not like every single time the subject comes up, me. So each time they're met with a conflict of interest, the nature must be disclosed. So next I'm going to talk a little bit about the bylaw template and sort of its purpose in creating a bylaw template. When we took a look at the templates that came in after the cull from May, there were all over the place. There were bylaw templates that were 2 pages. There were bylaws that were 30 pages. There were bylaws that were created by the group themselves. Some were created. It was just all over the place. And in thinking this through and doing some research, the template is meant to be a technical operating manual for an advisory board. The points included in it are to ensure relevant laws are followed, in this case, state law, relating to governance of advisory bodies for things such as quorums and voting, and to provide basic information about membership, meetings, and expectations. It is my opinion, my legal opinion, that the bylaws should be created by city staff and approved by either an elected or bureau director or designee. Members of the body and staff can recommend changes, but ultimately it is the elected or bureau director who should approve any changes. And the reason for this is to assure that the purpose initially set out for a board, an advisory board, doesn't go too far astray, so that there's someone there if the body would like to suggest doing something else, adding something else, changing a procedure, that there's someone who's aware that that change is being made. Those are sort of the legal issues that I have. I'm going to pass it along to my colleague, Ashley. I'll push the buttons for you.
and I apologize. I do have to go, but I leave you in Commissioner Fritz's able hands.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, well, good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. I'm really excited to be here before you today. I really am grateful for your leadership on this issue and the opportunity to address you today. It's been my pleasure to work with the other panelists you see before you and also members of your staff and others who are not up here today, many of whom serve on the Public Involvement Advisory Council, and they've been working on this as well. I want to just give a little bit of context very briefly and then get into some points around why these documents, these products that are being brought to you, are so important and will add value to the work that we're doing here together. I run, for those of you who don't know, a citywide community engagement program. There are 3 main components to that program, one of which is the Public Involvement Advisory Council, or PIAC. At the May session on the resolution that we're bringing reports to you about, we were very encouraged, PIAC was very encouraged to hear the enthusiasm here among all of you that PIAC would be engaged in this work, and PIAC has been involved. Another big piece of the program that I run is developing citywide public involvement policy and best practices tools to elevate our work and standardize our work across all of the bureaus across the city. In this work, the third bucket that takes up a lot of time, I do a lot of capacity building across the city, a lot of training and consultation with bureaus and groups of bureaus on issues. Just to share a couple of products that you may have seen come before you over the years, the Public Involvement Principles is a product out of PIAC and the program that we're all very proud of. Also, some of the Budget Advisory Committee standards came out of here. Comp Plan Chapter 2 language was a collaborative effort and came out of that program. And also the new Racial Equity Toolkit, which you have heard presentation on from the Office of Equity and Human Rights. My program is one of the co-authors of that tool because we believe that community should be engaged in government decision-making and reform work, especially in equity matters. The whole premise of this program and this work and really bringing people into advisory bodies is the understanding that those who are most impacted by something should be at the table making decisions about it. And so really, it's important, I think, just to step back and get bird's eye view of what is the role of boards and commissions, advisory bodies, why are they of added value to you in your work as you're making all of these important policy decisions. It's an opportunity after election to hear from constituencies about matters that are important and to work together to solve problems that are shared. In my role, my reason for providing that context, the role that I serve here at the city, I hear from so many people every day about the challenges that they face in coordinating and leading important public involvement work across everything that we do. And one of the big trends that I've seen over my 3 or so years here is just the need for more clarity, guidance, and structure as it relates to advisory bodies. PIAC has identified the need for this and is actually working on a number of things that will come before you, we're hoping, in the spring in the form of complementary recommendations that will dovetail with some of this. I want to give a... it's not projecting. Apologies. I've been told to keep to 5 minutes, so I'm doing my best to do that. I want to just speak to some of the products that we've all collaboratively worked on and have brought forward to you for your consideration, and share some, I guess, some added context as to why they would be so helpful in improving this work. So this need for a standardized application, I think, is a pretty obvious case. Just as a point of history, ONI has served as sort of like the default clearinghouse for applications to all of our advisory bodies, boards, and commissions, except for those that are very specifically housed in bureaus to advise bureau directors and so forth. And that is presented as a challenge, and that we don't have a dedicated FTE to manage that presently. And it's something that has come up at various points, some of which predate my time here and since I've been here. So I'm really excited about us hopefully adopting a standardized application and also getting to some of the FTE support needs that are present.
Can I just amplify that? Yes. The third from the last, be it further resolved, of this resolution says, as part of our next budget process, the Office of Neighborhood Involvement will request adequate resources to ensure proper and timely implementation of these policies. So it's baked into here.
Yes.
And I just want to say that, yes, there are going to have to be resources invested to make this work, and that was a very important part of the draft resolution that the city's committing through the budget process. You'll be requesting the resources, but presumably the city will look favorably on a reasonable request.
I certainly hope so, since I am assigned the person who will be responsible for developing an implementation plan and also executing it. So I hope you'll be favorable to our request for additional resources and FTE to move that work forward in the future.
Let me jump in as well. First of all, thank you for all the work that you've been doing, because it's been already too much for just one person. You've done an amazing job with it. Secondly, the intent on the standardized application is not meant to preclude additional information to be given via the bureaus to the specifics of whatever they're applying for. Is that correct?
Yes, that's my understanding. At PIAC, which the Public Involvement Advisory Council, which I staff, we have a standardized application, and sometimes we'll ask additional questions of all applicants, and we're actually... So yes, it's okay to have a standardized or uniform one across the city, which is helpful in a lot of ways and important. It's also okay to have more subject matter or specific questions that are asked, as long as it's consistent across the board. I wanted to share the importance of bylaws template. Also, I get asked by a number of staff who support these bodies questions about bylaws, and it is so very helpful to have a template that brings us up into compliance with existing state law and also addresses some of the other issues that have been addressed here today before my speaking that are of value and will again improve and elevate this work. And I think it will clarify a lot of questions that people who are serving on these bodies have, so that's also very important. Another thing, the exit interviews template, so very important that we have something like that to offer people who are serving and giving of their good time, or their time, their goodwill, and their expertise, and we know sometimes that people have wonderful substantive feedback to provide, and there's been no feedback loop created that's more standardized or official, and so we wonder how much good information we're losing or missing as to why people are leaving or potential improvements that could be made to the body and the work itself. I'll stop there. Those are just some points in support of these wonderful products that we have. I mentioned just a couple minutes ago that I will be developing an implementation plan and executing it. I'll be working with my bureau leadership. SOOC is aware that we're being asked to do this, and we will be figuring this out together. We estimate that this implementation will take about 9 or so months, and we ask for some flexibility there, considering the FTE considerations that we just addressed. Also be working proactively.
You don't need permanent full-time staff.
No, they do.
We do. I've been asked to assume this in addition to my existing full-time, full plate responsibilities, and so I'm saying yes, and I'll be developing a plan with my bureau leadership, and we will be needing additional resources because we have.
But what happens once you're through the bulk of this work of implementation?
Oh, what work would then that extra FTE need to do? Is that?
Are we talking one FTE?
One is my understanding.
Oh, okay. Well, yes. One. Okay.
Yes.
That's different.
This is, no.
I hear staff plural. And
oh.
That raises my.
We would be grateful
cackles.
For one.
Okay. This is the Saltzman line of inquiry on any issue where there's new FTE and there's the potential for mission creep. I think the point I want to make is that we have over 100 boards and commissions, and we may decide to prune that a little bit because we want to make sure we're getting the maximum impact. But those are commissions that have regular turnover, and that means new members that have to be trained. They have regular inquiries about, what they can and can't do. So there's a tremendous amount of work. And Judy is our legal resource, but we really need someone whose job it is to be the liaison, to do some of the training, to track all the disclosures and be the point of contact. And even that person, it seems to me, is more than a full-time job.
Thank you. The last thing I wanted to say is that we're working proactively and collaboratively with Judy Prosper at the City Attorney's Office. Judy did she's taken a number of leadership roles as it relates to this work and facilitated a couple of roundtables and has gathered wonderful substantive feedback from city staff who support these bodies. I'm aware of that feedback, and we are working together to anticipate other questions, concerns, and also be responsive to them. And especially as legal questions come up, I will be pulling Judy in. And then, my contact information. So if you have any additional questions, please do direct them to me because I'm the point of contact for this. Thank you.
Ashley, thank you for your great work.
Thanks.
Kofi, welcome.
Thank you. My name is Kofi Desu from the Office of Equity and Human Rights. Commissioner Fritz, Commissioner Odali, Commissioner Salzman, Commissioner Fish, thank you all for setting a new vision for the city's engagement with Portlanders who are willing to provide advice on policies, programs, and practices. I had the honor to work closely with Ashley, Brian, Judy, Claire, Sonia, and Amira. And I'm forgetting one name, please. Jamie. And I want to highlight, is this working? I want to highlight a few points in this process from the perspective of the Office of Equity and Human Rights. The first point is about the uniform application for the advisory bodies. The application form is the first document that provides the mission of the body, the advisory role of the members, and the expectations. Although the mission of each body will be different, the uniform application will allow the city to be consistent in the process and the data that will be generated, such as demographics. At the Office of Equity and Human Rights, we believe that it's important that city advisory bodies reflect the demographics of Portlanders. You know well that the city has been providing funding to train community leaders through the Civic and Leadership Program.
You're a little too close to the mic there.
Sorry.
There
we go. So community organizations have been training leaders and are encouraging them to serve on, government bodies. And this is going to be helpful for them. The second point is about the exit interviews. Members of our advisory bodies live with a variety of experiences. That would be a total loss if we don't have a collection system in place. The exit interview will provide rich data of based on experiences, including the accomplishments, the challenges, and the areas that need improvement. The third point is the establishment of standardized template of bylaws. This structure will save time for advisory bodies to focus on the analysis and advisory role they signed up for. The city-generated bylaws allow the city council to lead the vision and the mission of the advisory bodies while remaining open to recommendations from community members. The city-created bylaws also help the bureau director and the city officials to take ownership of the structures put in place to support the advisory bodies. From the perspective of the Office of Equity and Human Rights, I want to express my gratitude for establishing these structures. I believe if the city provides the necessary funding, the management of the advisory bodies will be more effective. Finally, the new standardized bylaws provide some flexibility that validate the great work that my colleagues Nicole Chiron and Tatiana Elihalde have accomplished to restructure the Portland Commission on Disability and the Human Rights Commission. These two commissions have removed the positions of chair and vice chair, and they are being more productive than ever before. They have established a new steering committee format, and they are more empowering for all members. We encourage everyone to continue the conversation about the importance of inclusive city advisory bodies. We are grateful for your new vision, and we look forward to continue to improve city policies, processes, and practices. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Madam Chair, do you have a second amendment you'd like to offer at this point?
I do, and we can maybe have them both on the table at the same time. This is an amendment to Commissioner Udaly's amendment on recusal.
I'll second it for discussion if you could explain it.
Ms. Prosper brought to our attention, and so have other speakers, that there is city code already in ethics law. And so my amendment, Commissioner Udaly's, which I also support, is when the conflict of interest could result in a direct financial benefit to themselves or relatives, as defined in state law, a public official shall refrain from voting on the issue. The end of that sentence for Commissioner Udaly is, although discussion and participation is still allowed. I'm recommending that we change it to and may not participate in the discussion prior to a vote. And that's because in Exhibit B on page 11, this is the existing city code. It says under objectivity, if an individual official's financial or personal interest will be specifically affected by a decision, the official is to withdraw from participating in the decision. And we've actually had something that came to council last year, or actually over the last term, where a member of the design commission was the applicant and yet participated in the discussion even though he didn't participate in the vote, is, I believe, what happened.
So, Madam President, may I make a suggestion? We have 10 people who signed up.
Yeah.
Judy is doing heroic service today. She doesn't feel great.
Yeah.
But she is available to walk us through the legal issues because we now have three different proposals. We have the current proposal, which is state law governs, Commissioner Udaly's proposal, which has a recusal component, and Commissioner Fritz's proposal, which has a recusal with a prohibition on participation. And they have different legal significance. May I suggest, because of the hour, that we defer on getting a legal analysis. We've heard the public testimony. Let's take the temperature of the room and then have the panel come back, give us some legal guidance, and then see where we are as a council.
Yeah, that sounds, if that's okay with everybody else. Potentially,
okay?
We could even hear testimony and then carry things over so that the mayor can come back and participate.
On this issue, the mayor had expressed an interest in participating, but I have a couple of suggestions how we can slice that, too.
Okay, let's do that.
Judy, can you hang out for another half an hour? You're getting... what is this? This must be some supplemental pay for hardship. So we have 10 people who've signed up.
Yes, thank you. Please read.
Okay. The first three are Tracy Prince, Terry Parker, and John Hollister. I don't know if he's still here. Let's go ahead and go with Mark Velke.
And John Hollister asked me to read his testimony. I don't know if you guys are okay with that.
I'm fine. I mean, considering all of the changing around we've done, that would be fine. So you can have 3 minutes for yours and 3 minutes for his.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm Tracy Prince. I'm the vice president of the Goose Hollow Foothills League. We care passionately about this issue, as you guys have heard repeatedly over the years. We're very proud that we have very strict ethical requirements, and a lot of what you've suggested today follows with our very strict ethical requirements for our board members. Thank you so much for this long overdue resolution. I really appreciate that all the committee emails are defined as public documents and that all committee members are understood to be public officials. I like that it's disclosing your conflict continuously. The term limits are absolutely important. We believe very strongly in that because we believe that that creates a strong citizenry who have ability to engage. That's why I'm not president, because we have term limits, and I'm really glad about that. I love the minority reports, which were so important on so many issues. I was really concerned before we entered today that it didn't seem like there was a definition of conflict of interest, but that has been resolved by some of the amendments. And the staff role in tracking the disclosures, which I hope is also made publicly available. The requirement to recuse, and we absolutely support the requirement that there is no discussion, because then you are able to influence people in a way that other people don't have access to, but you would be in a privileged position. I've been in meetings where people have voted to give themselves millions of dollars. It feels awful, because it feels unethical, because it is. And I've been very concerned that our laws haven't kept up with this. So I feel like this is so crucial, because we should not be participating in such an unethical situation. Bad things happen when committee members focus mostly on their own profits rather than the public good. Rich developers will still vote to give themselves millions unless we have these rules in place, as they did on the West Quadrant SAC, as they did on the RIPSAC. Their votes to enrich themselves threaten hundreds of historic buildings and privatize iconic views at Salmon Springs and to and from the Vista Bridge. And I think that people should be focusing on what's best for all of Portland and not just what will make them the most financially. I have a couple of suggestions to strengthen this resolution. Number one, there need to be consequences. Right now, I believe it's an over $1,000 fine to litter your cigarette. So we should at least have a consequence that, I mean, maybe you can build it in a way that is both carrots and sticks, because there are ways to get compliance. But I feel like there must be consequences. And there needs to be a reporting mechanism for the general public, so that when people, for example, saw the West Quadrant SAC members voting in their own financial interest, what mechanism would exist in order for the general public to weigh in on that? Thank you. And I've been asked by John Hollister to...
Mr. Parker's first, and then it's John's turn. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for the opportunity. My name is Terry Parker. I'm a fourth-generation Portlander that's lived in the Rose City Park neighborhood most of my life. Frequently, I have labeled many of Portland's citizens' advisory committees as stacked decks, with the majority of seats at the table representing special interest agendas. A recent example of this trend was the Residential Infill Project Stakeholder Advisory Committee, organized under the auspices of then-Mayor Charlie Hales. This committee was heavily weighted with developer interests. The broad range of community interests were underrepresented. The committee embarked on a direction with end results that distinctly reflected developer objectives. Some of the comp plan stakeholder advisory committees also had a tendency to be slanted as to their focus and perspective. Where stacking the deck predominantly runs rampant is when it involves transportation issues. Although the citizen involvement may be equitably diverse as it relates to race and gender, stacking the deck has all been all about fostering social engineering. No way does this represent an accurate makeup of the means by which the majority of people move about in Portland. Equity is discriminantly absent as it relates to travel mode, where there are usually one or more seats at the table for all alternative modes, and while 75 to 80% of the trips in Portland are made by utilizing a car or truck, most, if not all, PBOT committees are entirely deficient of specific representation for drivers who, through the gas tax, are the primary financial stakeholders for all transportation system projects. At the Planning and Sustainability Commission, one of the commissioners has a well-known reputation as one of the most vociferous car haters in the city. There is a multiplicity of types of equity. What other sector of city government wholly rebuffs and snubs physical stakeholder equity and representation? Citizen advisory bodies need to proportionally reflect the makeup of the community. At PBOT, that must include seats at the table that proportionately reflect the mode split, thereby including transport, tax-paying, stakeholder motorists, as opposed to just beneficiary non-tax mode representation. I support the intent of this resolution to clearly define transparency and accountability of city advisory bodies. What still made some work is to include language that requires all types of equity. And based on something that Commissioner Udaly said earlier, I think there needs to be a limit on the number of bodies that any one individual can serve on at the same time. That will give more openings to the public. Thank you.
If you'd like to read Mr. Hollister's, please, Dr. Prince.
John Hollister asked me to read this, that he had to leave to attend a Prosper Portland meeting for the unreinforced masonry seismic upgrades. He looks forward to talking to you in the future about what seems to be a pattern on the advisory committees that he had dealt with. The things he's concerned with are the lack of committee transparency, the potential conflicts of interest by committee members, and the lack of public representation on committees. And by this, he said that he wants to see residents considered primary stakeholders, that right now the planning staff and other staff members in other bureaus determine that the stakeholders are the people who have the most at stake financially. And land use rule number one requires citizen participation. It doesn't require giving the best access to the richest people. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Belkey,
so can I ask a question, Terry and Tracy?
Mm-hmm.
How long have you been on the – I know you're on the Rosewood Neighborhood Board for a long time. How long have you been on the Goose Hollow Board?
5 years.
5 years? Mm-hmm. Okay. Does your board have term limits itself?
Oh, yes. So I did three before, and then I'm on my – sorry, two before on my second three. I did a big break in the middle, so – and we have term limits. You cannot serve more than 6 years on the neighborhood association. You cannot serve more than 2 years in executive position.
Okay. Does Rose City Park have similar?
Rose City Park doesn't have term limits, but we allow 25 board members, and I think we only have 16 now, so there's various openings. And if we got up to 25 and somebody really wanted to be on the board, we could probably accommodate that. Okay. I mean, there's no, as I say, there's no term.
I guess I'm wondering through this discussion, and maybe it's just a simple question, but does any of this that we're talking about apply to neighborhood organizations in terms of
I wish it
term
would.
Limits?
So, yeah, I wish all the conflicts of interest would apply to all business associations and neighborhood associations.
Okay. But this proposal,
wonderful.
I'm looking at Ms. Prosper,
well,
she says
one
no,
of the things I will say about neighborhood associations, if you get very involved, there's an awful lot of work.
Right.
I mean, you can spend 40 or 50
yeah,
hours.
And it's often thankless work.
Not everybody
yeah.
wants to do that.
Right.
So we often hear some arguments against having term limits. Oh, there's nobody else to do the work.
Right.
But inevitably, when we have two board positions to fill right now, and I thought, oh, my gosh, who will we get? But the more you knock on doors and the more you say, you know, hey, we need some more people, you find them. Mm-hmm. And so I believe that when there are no term limits, it leads to sort of many dictatorships, and the will of the people isn't reflected.
Thank you. Mr. Belkey, thank you. It's your turn.
So I guess I'll just leave it at maybe we should include those organizations in this resolution.
Well, that would be very far-reaching.
I want to cut this off.
Sorry.
Okay. Get back to that later.
Madam President, I do have a comment and a response to Ms. Prinz. Neighborhood associations are independent bodies, and the city doesn't dictate what their bylaws are. So we could certainly make suggestions, but we're not exactly the boss of them. And as to your concerns about enforcing the standards like recusal, mm-hmm. I wanted to let you know that there is language that states that a person serves at the discretion of the commissioner or bureau director in charge. If staff tells us that a person serving on a public body is refusing to recuse themselves, they could be asked to leave. But beyond that, it does.